Talk given Friday evening, 29th of November, 1974. It often happens that when we are in difficulty or in distress, inward distress, we turn our thoughts to something, to someone who is greater than ourselves. We may turn our thoughts to the founder of the religion to which we belong, or anyone whom we regard as a holy one, to whom we can look for help, for comfort. And if it is not one of the founders of the religions, it is to God, whatever our conception of God may be, or more impersonally, to that which is transcendent to us, altogether transcendent, to which we ascribe all power, all goodness, all understanding, and so forth. And we often find that this brings results. Quite often, the desired result, or something akin to the desired result. And we experience thereafter a harmonizing within our own nature, a healing taking place. Now there is a reason for this. The thought, the conception of the teacher, the Holy One, or of God, is something which is a very powerful force in the psychical atmosphere of the world. There are millions of Christians, millions of Buddhists, Hindus, Mohammedans, and so forth. And they hold in veneration their own teacher. So in the psychical atmosphere, there is a very powerful energy upon which one may draw when one thinks of the teacher as such. Remember, this is a real force, a real power in the psychical atmosphere of the world. And therefore, when one gives oneself to it, and because this aspect of the psychical atmosphere is in terms of the highest good that we know or can perceive, the result is something which is harmonizing. But it doesn't stay permanent. Because the sources of conflict, the sources of the dis-ease of the mind lies within ourselves. It acts, this drawing upon this power acts as a palliative. Sometimes it may be far more than a palliative. The effect may be so real, so powerful, that a veritable transformation within one's own psyche does take place. And one is changed. And when that change occurs, then we are permanently further ahead. Now, that which we call down upon ourselves by this means is proportional, if I may use that word, to our own realization within ourselves of the qualities of the teacher. The more I am Christ-like, the more I am Krishna-like, the more I am God-like, myself, the easier it is for that tremendous energy in the psychical atmosphere to work upon me and through me. In finality, the fact is that the teacher, the Holy One, transcendence, God, use whatever word you like, is within oneself. Oneself is in actual fact transcendence embodied. But we don't know this. We like to foster the thought of it. But we are unwise enough, and we are incapable enough to prevent that truth from operating through the psychophysical organism absolutely freely without let or hindrance. This, as we have seen often and often in past meetings, is due fundamentally to the fact that this organism is derived from an animal ancestor. It bears all the conditioning of its natural evolution. And on top of that is imposed our socio-cultural conditioning. Nature and human society and achievements and laid down ways of life have been the two powerful factors which have contributed to make us what we are. The vision of transcendence within ourselves, as embodied within ourselves, is considerably clouded by these two conditioning forces. Why shouldn't we have started off with the perfect vision? Had we done so, there is no development possible. There is no growth. The purposes of nature, the purposes of transcendence, if one may use a word like purposes in such contexts, need time, need the duals, and there are conflict in order that a process like growth may take place in anything and everything which exists. All entities are limited. We start off with limitation. And therefore, within the context of limitation, which includes the unawakened state, ignorance, the incapable state, is at work, and we have to grow out of that to the awakened and capable condition. Now, we have already mentioned this time factor which is involved in it. And we have talked about natural evolution. Now, this raises up a very interesting and very often a troublesome problem. The influence of the past. What is this influence? Science, as well as the orthodox religious teachings of the world, tell us that we are the products of all that went before. All the forces that have been in play have worked towards producing us as we are. Now, despite that fact as such, there are those who tell us not to look back to the past, but to attend to the immediate now, the immediate present, to attend to it so totally that the accumulated conditioning of the past is impotent against us. Now, the problem which arises is that if I am the product of the past, and I'm a product through a process of growth and development, surely it is perfectly natural to look back to the past when some present difficulty arises, either for the first time or for the third or fourth or 20th time, as the case may be. What did I do under similar circumstances in the past? Nations do that. When they are faced with difficulties, they look back into history for instruction as to what should be done. Now we must be perfectly clear about what we really mean by saying we are the products of the past. The immediate now, the immediate present, undergoes continual change. There are two aspects to that change. One is mere modification. The other is transformation, transmutation. Mere modification is just a rearrangement of what was already there. It is not related to creation, therefore not related to life and growth. This is in connection with modification, a rearrangement. But when the real creative energy within us is at work, then there is not a mere modification, but a transformation. It is a change into something new and strange. Now remember the aspects of newness and strangeness. We all know from our personal experience that when we do come across something which is altogether new, we say, oh, what's this? How extraordinary or how strange it is. It is the unknown coming into, within the scope of our consciousness via the senses or a purely intellectual process or whatever it may be. You see? Now, the psychophysical organism of man, of each individual man, as he is today, here and now, is the result more of this creative, transformative energy than of the modifying energy. Consider how we are born. By an act on the part of our parents, which is unique in itself. There is nothing in our everyday life where we go through the routine of life and just modificatory processes which can compare with this thing. This is a creative thing. And its creativeness, the creative part of it, is right outside our ken. How does the creation take place? I don't know, do you? But it does. So, this organism is the resultant of creative activity mainly, life energy at work, which has produced us as we are. But life energy, creative power, is timeless, and it works timelessly. It is instantaneous. It is the great mystery. It's a totally new dimension of being, consciousness and action which we don't know. Therefore, this which is the product of the past, as we say in common parlance, is not something which we can trace back and say, ah, well, it was like that, then it was like that, then it was like that. We can say that up to a point, as we look back into the past. We can say it only up to a point, but only to a very, very small extent. This creative transformation, which is us in the immediate moment, is something which is a mystery. And to this mystery, which is timeless, which functions in terms which transcend time, this mystery does not brook looking back into the past for guidance now. Now, let us look at the process, the modificatory process which is at work when a person looks back into the past for guidance. The person himself, remember, has changed through the days and the years. Or if you like, the nation. The nation itself has changed through the days and the years. But the person or the nation bears in its memory the old shape of things. Now the memory born, the shape which is the memory is only a thought form in my mind. And it is extremely questionable whether that thought form is at all, perhaps only to a slight extent, true to the actuality of the past, of the living past. If it was, then if 10 people were involved in an experience 50 years ago, they should all have the identical memory of it, but they don't. Each person's memory is so conditioned, so colored, so distorted by his own mind and the state of his mind, the play of his desires, his moods, his frustrations, his pleasures, and all the rest of it, that this thought form is not at all true to life. It is not true to life as regards what occurred in the past, and it certainly will not be true to life in the immediate now when you are facing the actual situation. Is that quite clear? Now, if then we try to use that memory of the past in order to face the present, the living present, we shall only be using something which is a corpse, which is dead. To deal with the present problem, the present situation, which is a living process. Did you ever meet a corpse which could influence the living? I haven't. Now, these memories of the past are like ghosts. They are the real ghosts. We carry them with us in our minds. Look back into your own lives. You have memories of this, that, and the other. You can't shake the memory off. And the memory won't shake you off. See, every memory is impressed in the cells of the brain and practically in the cells of the body. The living cell has that influence at work. So that it's no good saying, oh, I'm going to forget all about it. I cannot. Never be so unwise as to attempt to drink of the waters of Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. Because then you'll never be wide awake. You'll never be able to see the truth of the situation now. According to the intensity of unself-conscious attentiveness to the immediate now, all the conditioning influences of the past, which are embedded in us as memories, as tendencies as we call them, we naturally do things thus and thus as we say, all those will have practically no power over you in the immediate now. You may ask, well then does that mean that all our past experience is valueless? What was the point in going through all that experience? No, it's not valueless. Remember carefully, I said that we hold the past as so many thought forms, which are the corpses, as far as memory goes, from which we draw for dealing with the present, as we call it. But in the actual experiencing of any situation, from moment to moment as we live our lives, there is a part of that experiencing which is transformed into faculty. Now this faculty is a living power within one. For instance, we repeat certain mistakes again and again. Say, in terms of human relationships, we make a mess of things. Now, if we really look into this and feel it and consider it carefully as we go on in life, as a result of that attention and that consideration, a part of that experiencing is converted into a mysterious, invisible faculty within ourselves, intelligence. The faculty to perceive the truth of things straight away. And in the real perception of the truth of things straight away, if you can ever notice it, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult to catch it. You will find that that perception has its magical moment of silence where there is no thought formed, no thought formed, no conceptualizing about it, no verbalizing about it. You just know and there, it's done. Just like that. You've got it. You know, this happens again and again, for instance, when we study. The argument is difficult. The subject is difficult. I don't understand this. But I pay attention to it and try and let the mind be quiet instead of getting all in a turmoil because I don't understand it. Just do nothing about it, consciously. And maybe, after a time, suddenly, oh, I've got it, I see. Now, Can you catch hold of that extraordinary moment of the I see? That is the nature of timelessness. Because it is the timeless which is the unbound, the utterly free, the transcendent, which is completely beyond all ordinary thinking and verbalizing and memorizing and the whole host of it. You see? Now, intelligence in the real sense, in the deepmost sense, functions like that when we are truly human. That is how intelligence functions. Now, it is the functioning of intelligence which is the creative activity of the immediate present, the eternal now. You see why in all theologies wisdom, intelligence, omniscience are words which are used in connection with God or transcendence or the Holy One, the Son of God or the Brahmaputra or whatever you like. Now, the whole of the becoming process is working, or rather pushing towards the emergence of this intelligence in us human beings. That is one of the purposes of our existence. That's only one purpose. There are many wonderful and beautiful purposes. If we like to use the word purpose, and we may legitimately use it, because after all, we are functioning in a limited context. We are not the totality. You can't use the word purpose in relation to totality. Meaningless. But the limited context, humanity, us individual human beings, in relationship to the world and the world process, well, there are purposes. So now you see, the memories of the past, the thought forms of the past, have to be eschewed altogether. Don't try to push them out. Do the positive thing in this case. Pay complete and total attention now, unself-consciously, without any desire, without any preconception, to the immediate situation. In other words, use your senses. We all think that we use our senses. We don't. We use them very inadequately. And too many human beings the world over use them very clumsily and in a great many cases outrightly wickedly. So in their philosophies of action, whether they be political or economic or whatever they are, they will stoop to that which is against virtue, which is against the simple commandments. You see? We have great difficulties in our way, as far as not only understanding this, but even more so living up to it is concerned. It's easy enough to get the feel of it when we are gathered together and we have met together in terms of amity and a willingness to explore and find out. Not merely to believe the speaker or to disagree with him. That's all useless. But this inward exploration must take place in the listener continuously as the speaker is speaking. And this inward exploration takes place in the speaker also, all the time. Otherwise, he couldn't speak in the way that he does speak. It all just comes out. You draw it out. And that is possible simply only if the speaker gives his whole being to you. And similarly, if you are in harmony there, then we explore together. So it's easy enough, under such circumstances, or at least relatively easy enough, to get something of a clear vision of what all this means. But the moment we go our separate ways, and other influences are at play immediately, influences which disturb, which produce disharmony, which disrupt, then is the great testing. All the time we are tested. Haven't we seen that in our own lives, day after day? It is not difficult to be an angel in heaven. It is so extremely easy to be a devil in hell. Because of the togetherness. All the devils are just as happy as the angels, remember? Each in his own way. You and I are very fortunate in being men and women. We can laugh at both of them. And see their helplessness. The real helpfulness lies only within human beings. God has no option but to be God. And the devil has no option but to be the devil. But you and I have an option. This is one of the new and marvelous things emerging out of the human kingdom. Because remember, all the conceived perfections and fruitions and heavens and gods and angels and so forth, and all their opposite numbers, are inside this little brain box and nowhere else. Revelation takes place in here. When I point to my head, I don't mean just in my head, but in my whole psychophysical being. So, when we are in the outer world, and the outer world may be one's own home, one's own house, where there is conflict with other members of the house, or some difficulty or other has arisen. The tax collector, or the borough council, or whatever it is. Then is the time of testing. And what is it that is tested? Your strength, my strength. Your skill, my skill, to remain completely attentive, unselfly attentive. Have you ever experienced something like this? When the body is ill, or when you are at the dentist's, or whatever it is, and you experience physical pain, What is your first reaction? Your natural reaction, as we call it. You want to get rid of it. But this is the way of the unintelligent. Of the one who is in fear. It is because I'm in fear, I'm running away from pain. Take the opposite experience, something very pleasant. Then I run towards it and cling to it. And that is the action of a fool, an ignorant person. So you see how I function. Now, come back to the experiencing of a pain. I want to get rid of it. But supposing I'm a little bit wiser, and I say, as I experience the pain, that is a painful sensation. And observe it. This is how it feels. This is how it works. Really observe it. If you practice that, you will find some very interesting consequences. For one thing, you will be able to go through the pain without the pain overmastering you. Nor, on the other hand, will you be overmastering the pain. Because that is a state of conflict. But if you can just attend to the pain and feel it and observe it quite dispassionately, then you are in right relationship to the experience through which you are going. That is a state of harmony. It takes two to make a quarrel, isn't it? You're in the state of harmony and you are learning from that pain. You're learning all kinds of things. It would take too long to start detailing them. But in the process of that learning, you will find that there comes the point when you find yourself in touch with totality. This painful sensation is something which afflicts totality too. And if it is not this particular painful sensation, it is another painful sensation. In other words, pain, sorrow, suffering afflicts the totality of manifestation. Existence means pain. And existence means the activity of the time process, the becoming process, in which growth, coming to fruition, etc., takes place. See? But there is a coming to fruition which is altogether beyond the coming to fruition within the becoming process. It is the transcendent fruiting. And the mystery of the transcendent fruiting is that the sowing, the growing, the reaping, the fruiting, the reaping is all simultaneous. It's timeless. It is a state of awareness, of consciousness, which is possible for man, but which is quite indescribable. But it is the truth. And you will find that when, in this experiencing of pain, you realize that pain is something which characterizes existence itself, then you will know what compassion is. It will just well out. Nothing disturbing. Nothing which comforts you or anybody else in the worldly meaning of the word comfort. But in the transcendent meaning, it is a strength giver. The strength giver which enables intelligence also to function quite freely. And then you will never struggle to throw aside pain or to put off death, because you will see through this compassionate vision that what we call life-death are a simultaneity. That is why I have always called it life, other life. I have never said life, well, I have in the past, following what the books of the past have said. But no longer do I say life, death. It's life, other life. It's the life, other life pulsation. And this other life pulsation is always misinterpreted by me down here, caught up in this limited sphere as death. In the sense of a destruction, in the sense of something which one wants to get rid of. So now, think on these things, meditate on them, don't think about them. Meditate on, let the mind be quiet, and see if what we have considered together this evening opens up something within your own being, by virtue of which the transcendent reality, this transcendent energy, flows in and out through you quite freely.